Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the program for July 24th, 2018, which in our calendar is the 12th of Av, 5778. I am Walter Bingham. My number for this week is 8,500, the explanation at the end. There are rumblings of disquiet in our country because of the inaction of our government against the terrorists of Gaza, who continue to cause almost immeasurable damage to our farmers in the south and are driving the population into bomb shelters despite the so-called ceasefire. Prime Minister Netanyahu is, as I said in a previous program, like the Roman Emperor Nero, fiddling while the South burns. On the other hand, as far as our foreign policy is concerned, Israel could not have a better prime minister than Benjamin Netanyahu, who of course also holds the portfolio of foreign minister. Unfortunately, however, when it comes to the defense of our country, he allows the minnow, that terrorist pest, Hamas, to play with our security, to burn our fields and forests, send rockets and mortars against our southern population, and cause havoc in our kindergartens. That has been going on for almost 4 months now, and all that our defense forces are allowed to do is to destroy empty buildings or shoot next to the launch site of kites and balloons. Kites and balloons that carry firebombs and explosives are weapons of war aimed at our civilian population, and the response has to be accordingly. In war, there is no moral high ground, but the aim to destroy the enemy or at best prevent them from harming us. Our Prime Minister is not doing that, and I am at a loss to understand his rationale. If his reasons are the response of Europe, then I say to him that he knows better than I do that their aim has always been to see us weak vis-à-vis our immediate neighbors, to wear us down with their support for BDS, etc., so that we become pliable to their policy of creating a Palestinian state in the heartland of Israel. Such a state would have to depend on European aid, and they would therefore gain a foothold in the center of Israel. Europe respects strength, not weakness, and we should make it plain to them in no uncertain terms that Israel is a sovereign country and will, as they would, defend ourselves with all means at our disposal. More after this.
Israel News Talk Radio, Straight Talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Israel is a sovereign country and will, as they would, defend ourselves with all means at our disposal. Prime Minister Netanyahu should take a leaf out of President Trump's book, who drops many of the diplomatic niceties and spells it out as it is. What is Netanyahu afraid of? It seems to me that he is more concerned with being accepted by European leaders as Mr. Nice Guy than to upset some of them by taking radical action against the rat's nest that is Gaza, where every nook and cranny in the residential areas is likely to hide a Hamas facility. It is no excuse that children are used to launch the balloons and kites. The same countries that are now rebuking Israel for defending itself are the very same that, as allies in World War II, did not care about children when they flattened Dresden. The Americans did not consider children when they dropped two atom bombs. And Hamas and their cohorts are actually hoping to hit our kindergartens. If Prime Minister Netanyahu is unable or unwilling to protect the security of our citizens in the South by deeds, not words, then I reluctantly have to ask him to allow someone else to do the job and concentrate on his foreign minister portfolio, at which he is excellent. I do not begrudge the Prime Minister to have some leisure, but at a time when the South is burning, he should have hurried home from Moscow instead of watching football. Then there is our defense establishment that is dragging its feet. Instead of the defense minister giving the orders, it is the chief of staff of the IDF, General Eisenkot, who seems to be dictating the policy. In a reported exchange with education minister and head of Bayit Yehudi, the Jewish Home Party, Naftali Bennett, who demanded the adoption of tougher policies against the balloon and kite offensive, Eisenkot said, "I do not think that shooting boys and children, who are the ones who launch the balloons and the kites, is correct. Are you proposing to drop a bomb from an airplane on a squadron of kite and balloon launchers?" asked Eisenkot. Following an affirmative answer, he continued, "This contradicts my operational and moral position." Eisenkot has no clue about morality. "It is immoral to pity terrorists from Gaza," said Bennett, "and not children from our communities in the Gaza area." "I will say this clearly," he continued. "It is better to be condemned by the world for killing kite launchers than to eulogize children who will be hurt in the kindergarten. Whoever launches fire balloons at our children is a terrorist and must be liquidated," concluded Bennett. To my knowledge, there is no clause in the Geneva Convention to consider the age of a combatant in the course of defending actions of war. Throughout history and in many cultures, children defined in the conventions as persons under the age of 18 have been trained and used for combat, assigned to support roles such as porters or messengers, or as in this case, kite launchers, used for tactical advantage as human shields or for political advantage in propaganda. By the way, I believe that in the 21st century, the age limit to define children is no longer relevant. Some economically powerful nations continue to rely on military recruits aged 16 or 17. I end as I began these comments. In war, there is no moral high ground. The aim is to defeat the enemy and protect the population. And if you, Mr. Prime Minister, cannot or will not do that, if you cannot stand the heat, then get out of the kitchen and concentrate on your portfolio as foreign minister, which nobody can do better. Walter's World is often referred to as the program with a touch of class. Not a lot, just a touch. That's because from time to time, we break into a bit of culture, like reviewing a serious book and talking to the author. So today, I'm doing just that. But this time, it's not the authors, but the translators who are in the limelight and internationally honored. Although the State of Israel was voted into being in 1948 and consultations with Germany began soon thereafter, official diplomatic relations were not established until 1965. So in 2014, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of that occasion, German Minister of Culture, Professor Monika Grütters, and the then Israeli Culture Minister, Limor Livnat, decided to regularly commemorate that event with the establishment of the Prize for Translation of Literature from German into Hebrew and Hebrew into German. The venue for the presentation was to alternate between Germany and Israel, so that this year is the second time it was held in Jerusalem. The two honorees were the late Nili Mirsky for her outstanding translation into Hebrew of Bekenntnisse des Hochstaplers Felix Krull, the novel by Thomas Mann, and Anne Birkenhauer Molat for her brilliant translation into German of David Grossman's novel, A Horse Walks into a Bar. My best translation is Kommt ein Pferd in die Bar. The jury came to the decision for Nili Mirsky because, among other points in her translation into Hebrew, she managed to achieve remarkable equivalence for the often complicated and winding style of Thomas Mann. They chose Ein Birkenauer Mulat for the use of a variety of German idioms and language nuances that brilliantly captured the Hebrew structure without missing any linguistic gesture and thereby developing the fragile atmosphere of this novel. It all took place at the Bibellands Museum in the presence of German Minister for Culture Monika Grütters and the present Culture Minister of Israel Miri Regev, who spoke first, but in Hebrew. Among her remarks, she stressed that this occasion is a connection between nations. Translations are the building of bridges. They are not a technical event or achievement, but an expression of human feelings and experiences, the transition from one sphere into another. Our getting together here is a ceremony that fits into the context of German-Israeli connections, a further expression of our cooperation. The motto of our connection between the Republic of Germany and the State of Israel is that we remember the past, we build the present, and we aim to achieve a better future, and that the past can never repeat itself. It is not only cooperation in the sphere of security and economics, but we see today that cultural cooperation can contribute to the people of both states getting to know each other and through that fight the stereotyping that still exists. Translation makes it possible to understand the mentality and emotions of the author, and that also brings closer the traits of each nation to the other. The German culture minister, Monika Grütters, speaking in German, began by saying that we Germans have to be thankful that our land is remembered in Israel not only for our continuing responsibility for the immeasurable suffering and deeds of horror, but also for the innovative strength of our literary classicists. Nili Mirsky's congenial translation of multiple works of Thomas Mann allows it for the German literary inheritance to be accepted in Israel as an enrichment of their culture, which is not self-evident. Both prize winners prove themselves with their masterly translations as contributors to intellectual understanding. I am happy that with my visit in Israel, I can not only strengthen our cultural cooperation, but also our friendship. In the knowledge that ours will never be normal relations, it seems almost like a miracle that after 70 years of the establishment of Israel, Germany may count itself among her closest friends and partners. Who would have dared to hope for this at the inauguration of diplomatic relations between our two countries some 50 years ago? The prize for the late Nili Mirsky was accepted by Mr. Pelek, a friend, and Ein Birkenauer Mulat stepped up to receive hers from ministers Monika Grütters and Miri Regev. To conclude, Monika Grütters welcomed the fact that both ministers were women, and so were both prize winners. With me now is Mrs. Ein Birkenauer Mulat, who is one of the awardees of the Translation Prize for Literature, given jointly by the Culture Ministries of Germany and Israel. She translated the Israeli novel by David Grossman, A Horse Walks into a Bar, into German, Ein Pferd kommt in die Bar. And as you heard, her translation received the highest praise. Welcome to the program. You are not a native Hebrew speaker.
No, I was born in Germany. After finishing my high school exams, I came as a volunteer with a German organization, Aktion Sühnezeichen, what people do in Germany, which goes through the countries who suffered from Nazi Germany. So I came as a volunteer in 1980 for 18 months and worked in Jerusalem with elderly people in Kiryat Yovel. During this time, I fell in love with the Hebrew language and with the people here, and I stayed in order to learn also written Hebrew, because then I was only talking. Then I learned written Hebrew, and then I went back to German and studied Jewish studies and learned Biblical Hebrew and Mishnaic Hebrew and Talmudic Hebrew. And then after quite some time, I came to Israel, and I converted to Judaism, which took quite some years, and since then I live here.
That's an enormous success in the very short time, really, 30-odd years that you've been here. What made you then go into translation of literature?
First of all, I come from a family of translators. My father was a translator for American literature into German, and my mother is a publisher of bilingual poetry. So, in a way, I got it from home, but I wanted to show all the things I fell in love with when I came to Israel to German people. Translating poetry to German was a way to show them what sort of culture we have here.
And it's widely read.
My translations are widely read. Also, this special book with poetry by Dan Pagis, they've sold some 3,000 copies, which is quite good for poetry in Germany.
Are Germans interested in Israeli and Jewish literature? The answer after the break.
I'm Jono Vandor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
We're going to be talking about...
What are we going to talk about?
A person who takes out a terrorist with a pizza tray.
And there's Donald Trump talking to a turkey. What's that about?
A 71-year-old rock star is a staunch supporter of Israel.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind.
Every Thursday.
Now, here is Walter Bingham.
Are Germans interested in Israeli and Jewish literature?
Of course, very much. Maybe that in the last years it's changing, the interest is getting a little bit down. But something what many people don't know is that after the Nazi time, the German publishers already in 1945 took about themselves a sort of oath that they said after this period of closure that nothing foreign was allowed to enter German culture, 50% of all titles we publish has to be translated from other cultures and languages. And this is like this until today. I think there is no other big country with a big language. I don't speak about Holland, let's say. They translate very much. But German culture is full of translated literatures. Also, Hebrew literature has a big part of it. And for many Hebrew writers today, the gate to the world is through German publishers because they do so much more than, let's say, what is translated into English. Into English, big authors get translated, but smaller ones don't.
How is that accepted today? Because the climate about Israel is changing in Germany now. There are, unfortunately, very many incidents that are unpleasant. Does that translate into this field of literature?
I think so. I think the numbers of Hebrew books which get published, translated to German, are going down. But that's also because of the book market in Germany is getting smaller. But I think there is a big influence of the political climate. A very interesting thing which two of my editors explained to me, that because of the presence of radical Islam in Germany and the awareness of the people, everything what is connected to religion, not only to Islam, also to Judaism, is in a way put with a very negative mark. So books which have I myself specialized because of my history and because I became Jewish and I did much Jewish learning into bringing Jewish Hebrew culture to German readership. And when I try to bring them books which have a very strong Jewish side, not only Israeli, but Jewish side, they tell me today we can't publish this today because people don't want to read about religious culture. No.
You've been particularly praised because of your knowledge of translating the idioms and the nuances of the language. I must come back to that. You've just learned Hebrew. How did you manage to get into such depths of literary language?
Reading, I think, is one thing. And the other thing is, as I come from a family where literature is a very central thing, you get some tools. You grow up already with these tools.
What's your next book?
I'm doing now 100 poems of Yehuda Amichai. He was translated 20 and 30 years ago, but the translations are a little bit oldish today, and they don't show to the public of today how much he was a revolutionary within the Hebrew-Israeli culture. So I try to develop a new German sound of Amichai, and I will do some 100 poems.
Am I right in thinking that to translate poetry is very much more difficult than prose?
Sure. You are so much bound by... First of all, you don't have many words, and you don't have many lines, and you don't have time to explain something. You have to evoke these things. And it's not easy, because in Hebrew, all the grammatical endings rhyme. And this already makes even a prose text very nice sounding. But in German, you don't have this. So often there are things which are rhymed in Hebrew, which are really rhymed in the end, which I don't rhyme, but I do other poetic things within the line in order to give it the impression that it is a poem.
In German, there are very many more words than in Hebrew.
Does that have an effect on trying to translate?
Not really. People often ask me about that, and I don't work in the other direction, but I don't have the feeling that the Hebrew language is poor, because the possibility in Hebrew to take one root and to make 20, 30 words out of it, and all this is so rich. Of course, in every language there are words and things and feelings which you don't have a word for, but you always can say them in three sentences. I believe in translation.
And Birkenhauer Mulat, thank you very much. And again, congratulations to having received that prestigious prize.
Thank you very much.
Because we are approaching the anniversary of the sentencing at the trial of the Nazi concentration camp doctors in 1947, you will hear my conversation with an eyewitness, the court reporter at the trial. So, what follows now is an account of cold-blooded, premeditated cruelty to innocent human beings, not carried out by psychopathic or deranged individuals or a fetish for personal gratification, but by 22 men and one woman, highly educated members of a profession that is dedicated to the welfare of their patients, who, having sworn the Hippocratic Oath, pledged to keep them from harm and injustice.
Vivian Schwitz, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You were a freelance court reporter in Detroit when you heard of the impending trials of the major Nazi war criminals in Nuremberg, Germany, and the need for reporters there who have your skill. You applied, passed the shorthand tests, were selected, and then what happened?
I was only 20 years old. I was 1 year too young. And so therefore, I had to wait until I was 21 before I could go.
So you were sitting at home for a while then?
Yes.
There were a number of subsequent trials, of which one is the subject of your book.
That's correct. That's the first trial.
Verbatim recording of court and parliamentary proceedings is a very strenuous job, and you were so young. I watched these reporters in the British Parliament where they changed over every 15 or 20 minutes. How long did you have to sit at any one time?
We sat at 15-minute turns, and it would change from time to time. It might be as long as half-hour turns.
Really? Did you have one of those specialized punch tape machines or take it all down in shorthand?
No, I was a Greg shorthand writer, but I had to pass the same high-speed shorthand examination that the stenotypers use, the machine writers, we call them. At 200 words per minute, then, I have gone on to pass 260 words per minute.
Wow. Do you ever get cramp in your hands?
Never. I never did.
Oh, well, that's fortunate. You were presumably under U.S. military discipline. Did you wear a uniform?
Oh, no.
I want to particularly talk about the trial of the doctors.
Yes.
Had you any idea what to expect before that trial unfolded?
Being the movie tone newsreels in the movie theaters about the atrocities as they were revealed upon liberation of the camp. And that was the only kind of orientation that I had. I was so horrified, and to think that doctors were capable of this.
Tell me about your feelings when you first entered the courtroom where these monsters were tried.
I walked straight up to the reporter's desk attached to the front of the judge's desk. It was a very long desk. So I scanned all of the doctors in the second row, and then I scanned the first row. None of the doctors paid attention to me particularly, until I got to the number one defendant, who was Dr. Karl Brandt, Hitler's personal physician and the chief architect of this entire program.
You published a book called Doctors from Hell. In the book, besides the actual transcript, which gives some insight into the mind of the perpetrators, you describe many of the experiments, at least a dozen, which involve many different procedures. Can you list them for our listeners, or at least some of them?
Oh, yes, I would want to. There were 12 major experiments that were charged. First was high altitude, These victims, in an all-concentration camp inmates, these victims were locked in airtight, ball-shaped compartments, and then the pressure was altered to simulate high-altitude atmospheric conditions up to 68,900 feet without oxygen. Oh, yes, I would want to. There were 12 major experiments that were charged. First was high altitude.
Now freezing.
Well, the second one was freezing. And this also had to do with the German pilots who were shot down in the freezing water. These experiments were conducted to test the most effective means of heating severely chilled or frozen people. These victims were placed in long, narrow tanks of ice water for up to 3 hours, at which point death occurred. Or by keeping them outdoors naked, 9 to 14 hours to sub-freezing temperatures.
These prisoners on whom these experiments were carried out, they didn't pass out?
Oh, yes, they did. They died. Not all of them died, but they were frozen to unconsciousness, and then rewarming of those who did not die was most effective by very hot baths. Then Heinrich Himmler, chief of the Gestapo, who committed suicide after his capture by the British, and therefore was never tried, ordered rewarming by naked women. 4 gypsy prostitutes, prisoners, were produced from Ravensbrück camp, and the chilled to unconsciousness naked male victim was placed between 2 naked women.
It is unbelievable stuff. Now, yeah. I take it that all the defendants were in court together every day, and you saw them every day. What was the closest you ever got to them?
Well, within 2 feet. Karl Brandt, when I first entered that courtroom and looked at him, his eyes were boring into my eyes with such evil. He was the only doctor who looked at me that it sent a chill down my spine. The prosecutor, General Taylor, noticed it, and he said later he thought it was because I was tall, blonde, and blue-eyed. His ideal Aryan.
I see, yes,
and
of course.
I had to walk by him, within 2 feet of him, every 15 minutes that I was in and out of the courtroom, 5 or 6 times a day.
He sat at the end of the row, and he was closest to you as you left.
Stay tuned for more.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Morris from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Well, the second one was freezing, and this also had to do with the German pilots who were shot down in the freezing water. These experiments were conducted to test the most effective means of heating severely chilled or frozen people. These victims were placed in long, narrow tanks of ice water for up to 3 hours, at which point death occurred. or by keeping them outdoors naked 9 to 14 hours in sub-freezing temperatures.
These prisoners on whom these experiments were carried out, they didn't pass out?
Oh, yes. They died. Not all of them died. But they were frozen to unconsciousness, and then rewarming of those who did not die was most effective by very hot baths. Then Heinrich Himmler, chief of the Gestapo, who committed suicide after his capture by the British, and therefore was never tried, ordered rewarming by naked women. 4 gypsy prostitutes, prisoners, were produced from Ravensbrück camp, and the chilled to unconsciousness naked male victim was placed between 2 naked women, indicating the obscene sickness of Himmler and his doctors.
It was unbelievable stuff. I take it that all the defendants were in court together every day, and you saw them every day. What was the closest you ever got to them?
Well, within 2 feet. Karl Bloss, when I first entered that courtroom and looked at him, his eyes were boring into my eyes with such evil. He was the only doctor who looked at me, that it sent a chill down my spine. And the prosecutor, General Taylor, noticed it, and he said later he thought it was because I was tall, blonde, and blue-eyed. His ideal Aryan.
I see, yes, of course.
So I had to walk by him, within 2 feet of him, every 15 minutes that I was in and out of the courtroom. 5 or 6 times a day.
Now, he sat at the end of the row, and he was closest to you as you left.
Yes, that's right. I could touch him.
Really? Now, being so close to those mass murderers who actually swore the Hippocratic Oath to only do good, how did that make you feel?
Of course, Hitler did away with the Hippocratic Oath and changed everything in that regard. But it made me terrified of these men. They were all resentful, and in the book, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has cooperated with me and at my request provided me with headshots of every one of these 20 doctors and 3 medical assistants so that you can look right into their eyes in those headshots and see the evil, the arrogance, the resentment.
And most of those are reproduced in your book.
Every one.
Yes. I have the book here, and it makes horrific reading. And when evidence was heard about a particular doctor, did you observe his reactions, his body language, for instance?
Just an almost stoical arrogance. And when they testified that they were involved in something noble for the fatherland, developing the pure 1,000-year ripe perfect race and eliminating all of the people they considered subcultures, the Jews, the Gypsies, the Slavs, and there were not only 6 million Jews slaughtered, but there were millions of non-Jews who were sucked into this vortex. Dachau concentration camp.
That's near Munich.
Yes, near Munich was where they concentrated all of the religious. The Catholic priests, mostly Polish Catholic priests, and Protestant ministers, and I think several Muslims. But all of the people, the homosexuals, they had categories of all of the people who were to be exterminated.
Is that not the place where they make them stand early in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, for many hours outside?
Yes. With bare feet on ice. On the snow. The cruelty and bestiality is unbelievable.
There were many witnesses, survivors of these horrendous experiments by one or another of these murderers. Were all these witnesses able to give their testimony calmly, rationally, and with self-control?
They did. They were able to handle their testimony with dignity, with seriousness, sometimes going into tears, The seawater experiments were conducted on German, Czech, and Polish gypsies who were deprived of food and given only yellow, brackish seawater for days, resulting in excruciating pain and eventually, in most cases, madness. And one of the most dramatic courtroom things occurred during my turn in the courtroom when a gypsy man, Carl Hollinger, assumed the witness stand and was questioned about why he was arrested. And then he said, because he was a gypsy of mixed blood. And then the Reich citizenship laws decreed Jews and gypsies cannot become citizens. And the Law for the Protection of German Blood and German Honor, dated November 14, 1935, another infamous Nuremberg law, stated a marriage shall furthermore not be contracted if the progeny to be expected from it would endanger the purity of German blood. And when Karl Hollenrenner was asked by the American prosecutor to stand, take his earphones off, proceed to the defendant's dock and identify the doctor who performed these experiments on him, who was Dr. Beagelbach, he flew from the witness stand and just seemed like he was flying through the air toward the prisoner's dock with his right arm stretched high, reaching for Dr. Beagelbach, the consulting physician to the German Air Force. Three of our American military policemen rushed from behind the prisoner's dock, grabbed this little man almost in midair, who was bent on delivering his own brand of justice, subduing him just short of his target. He had been able to hide a dagger on his person.
And he went for the doctor with a dagger?
Yes, with a dagger. And of course, after that, there was very great security about each witness coming into the courtroom, because he was determined that he was going to kill that doctor in that courtroom. He had been able to hide that dagger on his person and had been able to almost get to the doctor. But that was the most emotional scene in the courtroom during all the time I was there.
How did that doctor react? Was he indifferent? Was he angry?
Well, no, he was frightened. I mean, he was leaning back away from this man who was coming at him with a knife. He was shocked and frightened.
It's very interesting how these people who did such horrendous things to other people were frightened when someone comes for them.
Yes.
After they had restrained the witness, that gypsy, what happened then? Did he continue with his evidence?
Yes, he did. They brought him back after the judge sentenced him to 90 days.
The judge sentenced him to 90 days? What for?
For contempt of court. And at that time, I was the one who was so shocked. And I had tears coming out of my eyes because of what was happening, you know, with this poor guy who had already suffered all of this horror, all of these experiments. He was made to drink seawater. Brackish yellow seawater for days with no food and nothing else. And then liver punctures were made several times by this doctor.
It's amazing that he survived.
Both of them went mad, frothing at the mouth, just went insane.
Foaming at the mouth. Those who were still alive, most of them, what happened to them?
Most of them, they killed.
The book has lots of transcripts and, of course, your comments and your feelings. And it's a very, very difficult read, but it ought to be read.
I am in conversation with Vivian Spitz, who was the youngest court reporter at the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals. And we are talking about the trial of the concentration camp doctors.
Of all the terrific and painful experiments on human beings, two struck me as particularly horrendous. There was the procurement of skeletons of Jews for the Strasbourg University by what was referred to as defleshing. So they took people, defleshed them, and then made them into skeletons for the university students. And the other one that I found so horrendous was the instructions how to preserve severed head for further examination after the victim had already been, during his lifetime, measured and documented before being killed. And then, of course, also that they took 500 so-called idiots and epileptics, as they were described. They were studied and during their lifetime, and they too were killed and then their brains examined. This is almost impossible to conceive. What experiments stand out in your mind?
Well, I think the bone, muscle, and nerve regeneration and bone transplantation experiments were another that were so horrifying.
Can you describe them, please?
Yes. You know, legs taken off at the hips. And I have captured German film in my book of these experiments. A bin of legs, for example, that was captured. In my book is the testimony of one of the survivors, Karoluska, and I describe how she testified that she was subjected to 6 surgical experiments where she was held down in the bunker by SS men or in the camp hospital, and they slashed her leg, and then they took a hammer and they smashed her leg to break it into 2 or 3 pieces, and then they would take bone out. They would put pieces, slivers of bone in different places, and then heal the leg back up without any salpa or drugs. And she suffered 6 of these experiments. She was a lucky survivor who came to Nuremberg and testified from the witness stand, and I have her picture on the back of the book. I agree with you on the horrifying thought that they actually selected Jews, killed them, and you never heard such a silence in that courtroom as when they intoned the word defleshed to complete a skeleton collection.
There were also experiments with mustard gas and also with sulfanilamide.
Yes, sulfanilamide.
Yes, that was done on women in a women's camp, Ravensbrück, I think. Done by a woman doctor.
Yes. She was the only woman doctor. She was Dr. Herta Oberhäuser.
I'm looking at her pictures. Her eyes are stinging.
Yes, yes. Well, the sulfanilamide was the drug to ease the pain, kill infections, and when they performed the surgery, they used sulfanilamide to keep infections from developing.
So they actually caused these people to have wounds and then tried to heal them.
Yes, that's right. And then open them up again, even maybe in another place. She was awful. Yes. She was one of the worst.
Of course, we know of the concentration camp guards in Belsen and other places, people like Irma Greser and others. Those women were more cruel than the men.
Oh, yes, they were.
As the trial progressed, it must have taken its toll on you.
It did.
Did you get angry? Did you get depressed? Or at times feeling that it was all too much for you? Or could you take it in your stride?
Oh, no, I could not. My first weeks in the courtroom, I was just having tears come to my eyes and falling on my reporting pages that I was writing. And I knew I had to get dispassionate quickly because I had a job to do. To record verbatim all of this horror, you know, which I want the world to read about. The reporters and the interpreters bonded. We became friends because we were under such tight security where we lived and where we could travel. They helped me get through. They were by 5 to 20 years older than I was.
Well, you were really a young slip of a girl, weren't you?
Yes, 22 years old.
Yes.
And I had never, ever thought I would be reporting anything like this, and I had to. When I got home, I had a terrible time because I was having nightmares for 3 years. I was always escaping in a tunnel from a concentration camp, and for some reason, I had 4 or 5 little children with me. I was trying to keep them quiet. So the Nazi guard walking back and forth above with his bayoneted rifle along the barbed wire fence would not hear the children. It must have been I was escaping from the Theresienstadt concentration camp, the camp for the children.
Yeah.
Sometimes they would occur, you know, at least once a week, twice a week, for 3 years. And then I finally managed to get control of them until 1987. I was back here in Denver, and by then I was retired from court reporting on my Denver court, when there was a German language arts teacher in a high school in my Denver suburb who referred to the Holocaust to her senior students as the Holocaust.
I want to come to that subject a little later, if I may. Let me get back to the trial. During the final statements of the accused before sentencing, did any of them express remorse, or what was their general tone?
No, they did not. Not one of them expressed any kind of remorse at all. They were proud of what they're doing, or they denied on the witness stand that they had ordered these experiments until they were confronted with documents that showed their signatures. They must not have remembered that. They were in denial for everything.
Having seen the whole trial, were you disappointed that only seven of them were sentenced to death and that seven were even acquitted?
Yes, I was disappointed that only seven were sentenced to death, and I was shocked that seven were acquitted. I felt that maybe three or four of them could have been acquitted, but not seven. But you have to realize that the world was watching, and there were press corps there from approximately 20 countries covering these trials, and they were waiting to see if the American judges had found them all guilty and sentenced them to death. The world would have felt that it was not a fair trial. And I felt that our judges were leaning over backwards, trying to show the world that this was not a trial of vengeance, but a trial of justice over evil.
In later years, did you learn what happened to those who were sentenced to life imprisonment? Were they released eventually, as they usually do, or what happened to them? Are you aware of any?
They were sentenced to prison, but they never served out all of their periods in prison. Eventually, they were released by one of the American officers in charge of the U.S. sector in Germany. I could never understand that either.
Nor can I. Today you are lecturing internationally on the subject that you've so painfully learned. How do your audiences react?
I just spoke to 1,700 people in Phoenix at a convention, and I was told that everybody in the audience had tears. This is the usual reaction.
Well, of course, as I said earlier, the people today have no idea. It's a long time ago, and people really didn't read about that. At best, they knew maybe who Hitler was, but not a great deal more. And with all the pages of testimony and the admissions by the perpetrators themselves when they were, as you say, confronted with the documents, how do you explain Holocaust denial?
These people are hate groups. They hate all Jews. They hate all blacks in this country, all Catholics. It is a venomous organization, groups who become killers. And we've had several terrible cases in Colorado.
How do you explain the fact that with all the evidence that has been published and that we know about, and films and slides and witness testimonies, that there are people who say, as you said, it was a hoax, a Holocaust hoax?
Yes, I've been confronted seriously twice by the largest group in the United States called the Institute for Historical Review, based in Newport Beach, California. And I had to be taken off of the podium at the end of the talk at the Long Beach, California Hilton Hotel by a security guard who had to rush me off of the podium into the basement of the hotel for security because this group was in the hotel. I also was confronted in Colorado by this group. And the one man sat through my entire talk, saw these slides, and they claimed that all of these trials were sham trials. They were not real. And all of the photographs were fake and created.
Finally, I would be remiss if I wouldn't mention that for 10 years in the 70s and 80s, you were chief reporter in the U.S. House of Representatives, and you also recorded various presidents' State of the Union addresses. Which president's speeches did you record?
I recorded presidents Richard Nixon, President Gerald Ford, President Jimmy Carter, and President Ronald Reagan.
Have you ever been to Israel?
Yes, I have. In 1986, my trip to Israel was the trip that I felt was the most important in my life. And of that trip, my heart has been with the Jews ever since.
Now, your book, Doctors from Hell, subtitled A Horrific Account of Nazi Experiments on Humans. The book was published by Sentinel Publications of Boulder, Colorado. Vivian, thanks for having so vividly related your experiences. It was enlightening to have had you on the program. Thank you.
My number for the week was 8,500, which was, in fact, the number of Jews who were forcefully evicted from Gush Katif. Before I have to go, just to remind you, please visit your elderly neighbor. He or she may be in some discomfort during this hot weather that's prevailing in many parts of the world right now. Goodbye.
Did you ever want to join in on our shows and ask a question to our show host or their guests? Or maybe make a comment. Well, what are you waiting for? Join us in the Israel News Talk Radio chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com homepage, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us. Go now and try it out. It's the orange button on our homepage and pop-out player.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.